You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 84. On the last show, I interviewed Lane Kaplan-Levenson. Lane is the host of Sticky Wicket, a podcast about historic clashes between Louisiana politicians and the media. She was also the host of the critically acclaimed Tripod. It was a podcast that ran for more than 3 years and helped celebrate the New Orleans tricentennial. It was a fun discussion about Lane's unique lens on New Orleans and some of the highlights of the two podcasts. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen, then check out both Tripod and Sticky Wicket. Today's episode is all about Mardi Gras. Specifically, I'm joined by a former King of Carnival to discuss the Rex Parade and its impact on Mardi Gras and, more broadly, on the city of New Orleans as a whole. It was a fun glimpse behind the scenes of the oldest parading organization in New Orleans, and I know you're going to love it. Before we jump in, though, a word from our sponsors. First up is Two Chicks Walking Tours. If you love history and architecture, you'll want to take a walking tour of the Garden District on your next visit to New Orleans. Two Chicks Walking Tours may be owned by my friend Christine Miller, but it's also one of the very best tour companies in the city. We've been on the Garden District tour ourselves and had a great time with our guide, Loki. It's a fun way to learn about the history and architecture of the neighborhood, plus you get to explore Lafayette Cemetery and learn all about how we bury the dead here in New Orleans. Along the way, you'll learn about some of the Garden District's current and past residents. You'll see where Anne Rice lived, as well as the present-day homes of John Goodman and Saints legend Archie Manning, plus plenty more. Two Chicks offers several varieties of French Quarter tours, as well as tours at St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. But whatever you choose, know you're going to be in great hands, and you'll have a wonderful time. Plus, use code BEYOND and save 15% when you book your tour over at twochickswalkingtours.com. After you listen to today's discussion about Rex, you're going to want to plan your own visit for next year's Mardi Gras. And when you do, you're going to need a place to stay. That's where the Old No. 77 Hotel comes in. The Old No. 77's in the Warehouse District, and it's close to everything you'll want to do, whether you're visiting during Carnival or any time of the year. Most of the parades pass within a couple blocks of the Old 77, and the crew of Bacchus goes right in front of the hotel. The Old 77's just 3 blocks from the French Quarter. As I mentioned, it's close to lots of things you're going to want to do, including great places to eat and drink. Plus, it's near the streetcar lines, too. They have a wide range of choices when it comes to rooms and an award-winning restaurant, Compère Lapin, which, by the way, is open on Mardi Gras. The Old No. 77 is located at 535 Chapatoulas Street. Lots of Beyond Bourbon Street listeners have enjoyed a stay at the Old 77, and I know you will, too. Use code BBOLD77, so that's BBOLD77, when you book a room and save 25%. Plus, you even get a little lagniappe, a little bit of something extra, in the form of a $10 credit at Tootla for coffee and stuff in the morning. All right, with all that, let's dive into our discussion about Rex. Hey, y'all. Today's show is about Mardi Gras parades. Specifically, this one's about what it takes to put on a Mardi Gras parade in New Orleans, as well as the history behind one of the oldest carnival organizations in the city. I'm joined today by the historian and archivist for the School of Design, which puts on the Rex Parade, and we'll talk about that as we go. He's the author of Rex, an Illustrated History of the School of Design, and he reigned as King of Carnival in 2017. Maybe even more importantly and influentially, he served as pediatrician to thousands of New Orleanians over his 40-plus year career, including to my own children. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Hales. How are you?
Glad to be here and doing very well. Thank you.
And thank you for take two. We had a little bit of technical difficulty. So we're here in the Rex Den exactly 2 weeks before Mardi Gras. You might hear in the background quite a hum. There's a lot of activity here in the Den, as we'll talk about. At this point, they're loading up. They're fixing the final touches. They're putting the throws on the floats and just getting ready for the celebration we're going to enjoy in 2 weeks. My goal, as we were talking before we came on, Dr. Hales, is to really share with the listener not only the history of Rex and the work you guys do in the community, but also the sort of sense of place in Carnival and in New Orleans, and to give people who might enjoy Rex on Mardi Gras morning a little bit of insight of what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, people who come to New Orleans and visit here, see Carnival for the first time, initially they sort of stand with their jaws dropping because there's nothing like this anywhere else. This goes way, way back. People often wonder if New Orleans was the birthplace of Mardi Gras, and it wasn't. Mardi Gras goes back centuries and centuries and centuries. Mardi Gras is French for Fat Tuesday. Carnival, the other name for Mardi Gras, comes from the Latin carnivale, farewell to meat. You can't have Mardi Gras without the Catholic Church calendar, and this goes back to the Middle Ages. Ash Wednesday, the day when the faithful would give up everything, the pleasures of life, giving up eating meat, at least historically. The day before that great giving up, there was a great letting go, and that was Fat Tuesday, the day before Ash Wednesday. So that celebration also incorporated a lot of the elements of early pagan celebrations of springtime. So what you see in New Orleans now is just the latest iteration, and with a particularly New Orleans spin on it, of a celebration that goes back to the Middle Ages. Had you been, for example, a Frenchman in the 16th century, the day before Ash Wednesday, you would have celebrated Mardi Gras, but it would have been called Bouffe Gras. That means the fat ox. The tradition at that point was to, on the day before you were going to give up meat, you would select the biggest piece of livestock you could find, decorate the beast, gild the horns, put a garland around the neck, put it on a beautifully decorated wagon, and pull that through the streets of the city. Follow that with masking and dancing and drinking and carousing and celebrating. Slaughter the beast, cook it, consume it, stay up really late eating and drinking, and the next morning you get up and take the ashes and go into Lent. So that rhythm is where Mardi Gras comes from. It thrived in New Orleans simply because this place is at its heart Catholic and connected mm-hmm. to old traditions. So the very first Europeans who came here, Iberville and Bienville, we just celebrated the tricentennial of this city. Those European founders, if you will, when they first found the site that would be New Orleans, they anchored their boat down the river a little bit near a bayou. It happened to be Mardi Gras. They named it Bayou de Mardi Gras, and it's still called Bayou de Mardi Gras. So there never was a time that there were settlers, European settlers here, that Mardi Gras wasn't a part of our life and world.
And I think it's so interesting that, to me, Mardi Gras is foundational for all the things that people talk about New Orleans, the friendliness, the warmth. It seems to me it's the one day of the year where people that might not otherwise mix, whether it's just your social, you know, who you interact with socially, who you interact with business, where your kids go to school. But on Mardi Gras Day, and really through the 12 days or so of parade season, people tend to go to the same places. Right. And so you tend to see people that might be the people you see then and you don't see the rest of the year. And on that day, particularly as you're enjoying on Tuesday morning, Zulu and Rex and the truck floats, you're looking out for each other's kids. You're sharing a drink. You're sharing maybe some food. It really is a sense of community in a way that just I think is unlike most other places.
I think that's really true. This city rarely feels as close together and as with as many lines erased mm-hmm. Between whether it's race or class or money or color, whatever. People are out together. They're enjoying this tradition, this parade, and it goes so very far back. I mean, in the early days of New Orleans, even before there were any parades, there would have been informal gatherings and parading and costuming and masking and celebrating on Mardi Gras. In 1857, the Mystic Crew of Comus started a nighttime parade on Mardi Gras night that grew into a beautiful themed procession of rolling tableau. It's just a unique art form. They paraded through the time of the Civil War, stopped parading then, began parading again during Reconstruction. It was a nighttime parade. That started really catching some attention nationally. But the rest of the daytime celebration was sufficiently disorderly and unstructured that the city fathers were talking about in really instituting a curfew. Here come the Rex leaders, young businessmen, young city leaders who gathered one evening a few weeks before Mardi Gras in 1872. and wondered if they might make something of this sort of disorganized celebration. So within a few hours, they had invented a king of carnival. Rex is Latin for king, and chose the colors of carnival, purple, green, and gold, picked a popular song of the time, If Ever I Cease to Love. The motto they picked, Pro Bono Publico, Latin for the public good, really pointed to their purpose and still is our purpose today. Rex intended to do something that would be helpful to the city. The city at that point was really trying to recover and reconnect with its cultural and commercial partners around the world. And these weren't other southern cities as much as they were Boston and New York and London and Paris and Havana. Rex, this newly invented king, started sending out edicts commanding people to come to New Orleans and celebrate. And these ended up in railway stations and all newspapers everywhere. People read them and they came. And within just a few years, the Rex procession on Mardi Gras Day had grown into a similarly beautifully presented procession of beautiful rolling works of art that brought people from all over the world by the tens of thousands to witness this spectacle. And it grew from there. Now we have dozens of organizations that have parades and balls and so on. Comus no longer parades, but Rex, the oldest parading organization, we see our role as not only to continue to give this gift to the city of a beautiful parade, but also to anchor the traditions that make this celebration kind of hold its center.
Well, and as I was just mentioning, it feels like Mardi Gras is the glue. For all the challenges that we have as a city that's more than 300 years old, that day seems to be a day that people can come together and just celebrate life, celebrate New Orleans, celebrate the traditions that you describe. And my mother would say that it's not carnival until she's seen Rex. And she still lives with that. She expects to see the military bands come, and certainly the float that you had the opportunity to ride on a couple of years ago, and to get to wave to Rex and hopefully catch a gold doubloon. And then it's Mardi Gras for her.
It is. These are old traditions, and they really become iconic. You know, mm-hmm. that King's float, the mounted lieutenants on horseback, particularly on a beautiful day. That really is the centerpiece of the carnival celebration. You know, we talk about rolling works of art. This is such an ephemeral and unusual art form. The Rex Den from the outside looks like a warehouse. From the inside, what you'll see year-round are 27 floats, 20 of which are completely redone every single year. Every Rex procession will have a theme. This year, it's Visions of the Sun. 20 of the floats that last year were completely decorated around a theme that was a tricentennial theme, honoring that important anniversary for our city. When those floats came back in the den last year, they were backed into the position they would roll out this year. And within a few weeks, everything was taken off those floats. The beautiful sculptures in the front of them, the flowers, the painting all gessoed over, leaving really 20 three-dimensional canvases to start over again, creating art around the visions of the sun. So we have sketches prepared for next year's parade already. We have themes selected 4 or 5 years in advance. So this becomes a really weird artist studio. I mean, imagine that for a minute. If you were a painter and you put up 20 big canvases in your studio, and you worked on them all year, and then you opened the doors for a few hours and let the public take a look at these beautiful works of art, and they couldn't buy them, but they got to look at them and go ooh and ah, and then they left, you painted them all over, and started over again. I mean, this is not sustainable, but it's what we do, and it's the old tradition of this wonderful celebration, beautiful works of art. I mean, in the early first 40, 50 years of Mardi Gras in New Orleans, beads weren't thrown from floats. Nothing was thrown. People came from all over the world and filled our streets to see beautiful rolling works of art, and they didn't go home with anything except beautiful memories of an ephemeral art form.
And today, generations of New Orleans kids would be hugely disappointed, right? You take a New Orleans kid to the Rose Bowl Parade or the Macy's Day Parade, and they're not impressed.
No, it's not the same. And this is a very participatory process. And Rex has innovated there. I mean, we still make beautiful floats, beautiful rolling works of art. But we throw beads. We've innovated there. The first doubloon, really a gold coin, was a Rex invention in 1960. And I don't want to know how many tens of millions of doubloons are in people's attics, but there's a beautiful sight when the sun's out, particularly, and a handful of doubloons goes flying through the air, and people are grabbing them out of the air. And it's that, beads, cups, plush throws. I think we're throwing Frisbees this year. We've got, several years ago, we started having float, each float really with its own throws, its own set of beads. So if you have 27 Rex floats, they're 27 unique beads. And New Orleanians and tourists become really obsessed about having the whole set. So it's part of this. And you're right, if somebody goes to a parade somewhere else, it might be really great. But everybody's sitting on folding chairs watching it. Are you kidding me? This is not what we do here.
So you talk about, so the recent innovation with Rex over the last few years of having the throws themed to every float. We had a fellow parent last year whose child did not get the whole set and was so distraught. The mom just sort of reached out and says, anybody have like float 13 and 17? And we just filled it in because this little child was, you know, it was going to make everyone happy in the family to complete the set. So it's got some pluses and minuses there. But I did want to get, you were talking about, they're such works of art. And at their base, they really are wagons in a sense, right?
That's right. Wheels. Originally, these would have been cotton wagons. The wagon structures we use now are a little larger than that. They're old service wagons, probably from the turn of the last century. And they take a lot of work to keep those going. And then there's wooden three-dimensional structures built on top of that and muslin stretched across that. That gives you the three-dimensional canvas. But that also means that they move and they rock a little bit as you go down the street. So it's it gives some additional movement and it makes it a very dynamic process.
And I think it's one of the, some of the older crews, not many crews own their own floats, right? Maybe a dozen, maybe a little bit less than that, but only a few have the really, really old. And so it does absolutely give it, on a sunny day, it sort of shimmers. And I'm sure the artists take that into account,
right,
with the way they're designed and the materials. But you hit a beautiful day, particularly I think about when the floats come off of Napoleon Avenue and make that first turn to the left onto St. Charles Avenue there. You know, it just seems like on a beautiful day, it hits it, and you have the wobbling a little bit, and the weight, and the cacophony of music, and it just really comes together.
It is,
a thing that's hard to describe, really. I
mean, it is, which is why everybody should come. You know,
I agree.
Rex commands you to do that.
That's right.
These floats, and describing them, I mean, they're much. It's much better to see them, but one of the traditional ornamentations here is a Mardi Gras flower in various forms. Really just a couple of layers of thick paper with wire in between glued together so that it can be shaped, then painted. And these lovely flowers are all over the floats, and they also move in a nice way. The very last thing our artists do in the week or two before Mardi Gras is put lots of gold and silver leaf mm-hmm. on the floats and on the flowers. And when the sun's shining, that just adds a particularly beautiful look to those floats. And we do keep our floats here at the Den. We have artistic partners who work with us for sculpting and painting and so on. But they're to our designs, and there are lots of ways of having a beautiful Mardi Gras parade. I mean, the new Super Cruise now and so mm-hmm. on. Nighttime, lots of fluorescent lights and lots of whiz-bang stuff. But we still build our floats in a way that if a worker on floats came back from a century ago, they'd go right to work with our artists. They'd recognize the materials and the process and so on. It doesn't mean that the Rex way is the only way, but mm-hmm. but we do see ourselves as being the historic anchor and the artistic anchor of a celebration that's gone off lots of directions. I'm sometimes asked what Rex's founders would have thought about a carnival celebration now that has dozens of organizations, gay and straight and black and white, and if you're a dog owner, you've got a crew for that. So all of this is going on, and my easy answer is they would have loved it. Mm-hmm. They invented this great imagination, and would be totally delighted with how much it's grown and what it means to the city. You mentioned the how the city does feel together on Mardi Gras. The very special celebration was that first Mardi Gras post-Katrina.
Yes.
It was an open question whether we could, should, would have Mardi Gras that year. The Rex Den, where we are right now, was under about 5 feet of water. So our floats that were already mostly built for the 2006 parade, the theme that year, by the way, was Beaux Arts and Letters. It was a tribute to artists and writers who'd worked in New Orleans over the centuries. Really a gorgeous parade, but it pretty much ruined. And we did our very best to start cleaning that up. We had to send wooden wagon wheels off to Texas to be repaired because nobody does that locally. And our message to the city leadership was, we'll try to have a parade ready to go if it won't be a strain on the city, if it's the right thing for the city, if our resources will support it. And the other thing we were clear is that we would not be on the streets if Zulu could not be on the streets. Zulu, mostly African-American parading organization that is about 100 years old. We're about 150 years old. We work very closely with Zulu, and to have one of our organizations on the street without the other on Mardi Gras would be all wrong. Mm-hmm. So that was the way we left it. And as it turned out, 2006's Mardi Gras will absolutely be a historic one, something we'll always remember. We ended up with a beautiful blue sky day. The parade mm-hmm. route had been shortened. There were almost no tourists in town because the hotels hadn't opened. So who was on the streets? Yeah. We were on the streets. Those who'd been able to come back, but most importantly, people who hadn't yet. People were here from Atlanta, from Houston, from Dallas, wherever they'd had to go while they were getting their houses fixed and getting ready to come back to stay. And they came back for Mardi Gras. Yeah. And I heard it over and over again on the parade route. This one's for us. And thank you for being on the streets. We needed this. This is who we are. We're going to go back to Houston, but we'll be back here to stay.
I was on the streets that morning, and it's still emotional thinking about it. It was, you saw lots of people, crying, hugging, but very much what you said. It was, Arthur Hardy likes to talk about Mardi Gras Day, or Mardi Gras is the sort of greatest free show on earth that we throw for ourselves and we let others come and enjoy.
That's a good description.
And that day was very much, I think, sort of back to the roots of, this is for us. Crowds were a little bit lighter, but just as wonderful. You're right. It was a beautiful day. It was a special day, and I think it really did, the fact that Zulu and Rex paraded to get paraded made such a difference to the community, because it is, Zulu comes in first and Rex's route joins up behind Zulu if you've never been, and it's important to New Orleanians, and that combination, the whole thing, the day was really special.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that reminds me of in terms of our commitment to the community, the gift that Rex has always given to New Orleans is a beautiful parade that has helped to anchor this burgeoning celebration that's so important. I mean, it's the anchor of our tourism industry. It just is, it's important in that way. Post-Katrina, pro bono publico, for the public good, our motto, really had an opportunity to be expressed in a new and different way. The public school system in New Orleans pre-Katrina had been a dismal failure. Our arguably the worst or near the worst public school system in the country. Post-Katrina, the school board threw up their hands. They said, we can't open any schools for at least a year. Our organization and others worked carefully using the state's charter school law to help open and launch public charter schools. These aren't for-profit. They're open admission. They simply opened schools that allowed children to return to the city and have a school where they could learn, be safe, and grow. We now, 12 years later, have a model of public school reform here in New Orleans. Virtually 100% of our children are in public charter schools. We have increased our performance in many ways, in many areas, surpassing the state averages, which is remarkable. Still not good enough, because state average is pretty low. But we've become a model of urban school reform, and our children are in schools where they are learning and growing. We have one of the highest graduation rates now in any urban school system in the country. And Rex leaders have been, have served on those boards, have worked carefully. We started a foundation post-Katrina called the Pro Bono Publico Foundation. Our members have contributed over $8 million since Katrina purely to support public schools. Our firm belief is that if our children have access to an excellent education, that opens doors for them, and that's our future. So when I look around and I see that contribution, once a year we have the grant recipients come to the den to receive their grants. This den fills up with wonderful young educators, lots of students, and that commitment to our children has become a really a central part of our mission, and I think a new and worthy expression of the intent of our founders, Pro Bono Publico.
Well, and we were talking again just before we came on that this time of year, maybe all throughout the year, you get school groups come in. And I think, gosh, as a New Orleanian growing up, I only came into the Rex Den maybe a decade ago, maybe less. But gosh, what an insight and what a wonderful chance to sort of spark imagination and creativity and see the artwork and learn about the history that, gosh, most New Orleanians still never get to see behind the scenes in that way.
The children love it. We will have upwards of 2,500 school kids through the den this year. And we have docents and guides who help with that. But what these children will see, two things. One, they'll get a close-up look at these beautiful floats that are flying by on Mardi Gras, and things are being thrown, and it is wonderful to see their attention shift to that art, and also the lessons to be learned there. You know, the name of our organization, the corporate name, is the School of Design. Mm-hmm. That's how the Rex organization was incorporated in 1872. I always wondered about that. You know, clearly design has something to do with a lot of art here, but I love the school part of it. There is a lesson to be learned from every one of these floats. Visions of the sun. We have figures from mythology and history. We have images that pull something out of literature, and each of them has a little story to tell within that overarching theme. We help the kids learn about that. We started a program ages ago, Rex in the Classroom, that lets classroom teachers take our material from the website about the upcoming parade and use that in their classrooms, art projects, history projects, other things. And hundreds of classrooms do that. When those kids come to see the den, they know those stories already. And when they're on the streets and their parents can't figure out what's going on, they'll explain it to them. No, Dad, that's this Greek god, you know. And they can tell them a story, and I love that. I mean, children, they get to see the parade. We can show them the areas now. We have two rooms with pretty extensive historic displays now that also let us tell those stories. So children can leave here, and adults when they come, understanding better not just the art that is made here, but also the history that anchors the celebration.
Yeah, I think it's been such a wonderful addition. Again, as you were saying earlier, if you think back to the founders of Rex, they would be very proud of that, I think, and say this is a direct, you know, this is what we envisioned in a now 21st century interpretation of that.
Yeah, we hold on to the art, but we hold on to that core mission of trying to give this city what the city needs through leadership. I mean, when I look at the portraits of past kings of carnival in the museum area downstairs, I mean, that's just, to me, a library of service. I see men who really committed themselves to this city in important ways over 150 years. And that's just part of our tradition. And I'm just very proud of the way Rex members have seen the opportunity in education as a way of either of furthering that mission. It if we can get things right for our children, a lot of things get right in this city. And that, again, crosses racial lines, socioeconomic lines. If we're going to have a wonderful city, we need to assure that our children have opportunity.
Well, and you mentioned Rex, the king of carnival, each year, often, almost always, a civic leader, someone who is generally well-known in the community, has done a lot, perhaps in their business life, but certainly in giving back to the community in various ways, across all kinds of, as I think of just the last six or seven different parts of industry or society. By contrast, for maybe people that aren't used to carnival, so that tends to be a successful, I'll say slightly older gentleman, by the time you've achieved that measure of not only success, but giving in the community. And your queen that day is a debutante.
Yes. The queen of carnival will be a debutante, a daughter of a member. Really, that's part of the tradition pretty much across every organization, especially the old line organizations. The first year, Rex didn't have a queen of carnival. The second year, actually a married woman, Mrs. Walker Fern, who was picked somewhat in an impromptu way. And she complained later if she'd known that, she wouldn't have worn her second best black dress. So the first queen of carnival wore her second best black dress. But by the next year, a debutante of the season was selected. We ask a lot of these young women. Mm-hmm. That day, although the queen of carnival is not part of the parade, she'll wait at the receiving area at a reviewing stand downtown. But that night at the Rex Ball, which is more an imperial reception than a ball, people don't go there to dance, but there's lots of processing, lots of sceptering, and a lot of choreography and a lot of tradition. And it is a demanding and exciting. It gets to be a bit of a blur. The Queen of Carnival wears a beautiful gown that is created for her and just worn that one night. We have two examples of that on display here. But it's part of the tradition, and it both Queen and King of Carnival the morning after go right back to their old lives. Most of the Queens of Carnival are on an early flight back to college, and the Kings of Carnival are probably taking out the garbage the next day.
So you just hit on one of the points before we came on air. Again, your former patients, my daughters, Olivia and Sophia, their question was, why does the Queen not get to ride on her own float? But as you mentioned, she has a long day.
A very long day, and I think by the time you get to the end of the Rex Ball, then the Rex Court, King and Queen of Carnival, and the rest of the court cross the street to visit the Comus Ball, old tradition going back to the early years of Carnival. And there, Comus and his queen, Rex and the Queen of Carnival, greet each other, and they process together, and that meeting of the courts is really the very last official act of Carnival. When the curtain is closed on that, everybody is about ready to go home, but they don't. They go from there to the Queen's Supper and party a little bit longer and then go home. But it is a long day. I think with all the Queen of Carnival has to do that evening, she should not spend her day on a float.
And you alluded to it there that the day begins very early for all of you, right? I mean, you start early. There is usually the tradition nowadays, I guess, of the Queen's Run. Is it the Queen's Run?
Yeah, it's called the Royal Run. and that was actually started many, many years ago by Boatner Riley, who's a beloved leader of the Rex organization, leader of Riley Food, and been chairman of the Board of Governors at Tulane. Wonderful, wonderful man. And he loved to jog, and he loved to jog in Audubon Park, and he liked to do that every morning. So the morning he was going to reign as Rex, the King of Carnival, he said, "I'm still going to run." So some T-shirts were made, and Mr. Riley and dozens of others showed up at Audubon Park, and somebody pulled the lanyard on a cannon, and off they ran. And that's been the tradition ever since. So that starts bright and early at Audubon Park. The King and Queen of Carnival will start the race at the sound of the cannon. The Queen of Carnival always wins, and then it's off to get dressed and ready for the rest of the day.
And it's a long day for people that aren't familiar with carnival. You guys are coming here to the den. You're getting dressed, loaded up, all the throws, not to mention the nourishment and everything you need for the day, gets onto the float. The procession itself is hours long. If everything goes well, it's hours long.
Yes, it's 3 or 4 hours on the float. I had two fine young pages on my float, and they were stalwart. But every now and again, the parade will kind of stop for whatever reason, and At one point, I looked down, and one was taking a little nap down at my feet. But no, it is a happy and a loud blur on the parade route, especially from that vantage point.
I had not thought the pages are usually 7, 8, 9 years old.
Yeah, 9 or 10 years
okay.
old.
Okay, that's a long day, and those young boys, they don't get to throw anything.
Nope.
So they're on the float with Rex, so they get to wave.
Yeah, they might have some doubloons to hand out, but they're
that's a tough day.
They're right. Mostly there. I mean, that evening they'll help at the ball to make sure that the mantles get arranged properly and so on. But this is one of the very few cities where you could get young men of that age to put on tights and rouge and a little lipstick
and a wig.
Wig and a feathered cap. I mean, that's but you know, every community has some history and has some traditions, but New Orleans history and tradition go deep and broad. They really do, over many, many generations. And it's one of the unique things about this city. There is not the same transient kind of roots that don't go that deep. We do hold on to traditions here. Some might suggest that that's a drawback, that if we're that focused on doing things that have been done that long, we're not focusing on other things. I think there's a wonderful place for both of those. And I think if you look at this celebration today, as broad and exciting as it is, it makes it better to have historic roots that go back a century and a half.
Well, and I think, and you alluded to it earlier, essentially the bulk of the parades take place in the 12 days preceding and leading up to Mardi Gras. There's some earlier, we've just passed a couple of the small ones, but you can see the lineage of the oldest crews, like Rex, and even some of the undercarriages of some of the very old parades are now used in some of the newer ones. And then you can see the super crews, as you described, and I would say the recent rise of women's organizations like Muses and Knicks, and of course Iris is 100+ years old as well. But it feels like Mardi Gras is really a good symbol of what New Orleans is. At once you have the old and the traditions and brand new takes on that. So you can go to an Antoine's or a Galatoire's or an Arnaud's, or you could go right down the street to a very modern Revolution comes to mind, or August or Tableau, and blend both those 300+ year old traditions with a new take on it. And Mardi Gras does the same thing.
It does. And I think you've described that well. And I would submit that most cities would invent that if they could. But it's not going to happen in Atlanta. It's not going to happen in Dallas. It's not. Our 300 years here are important to us, and there are strands of what we do, who we are, how we act, what we value that go back through all those years. And you know, Mardi Gras is just one element of what New Orleans is about. I encourage people who haven't seen it to come. One of the discouraging things is that the images that most people see of Mardi Gras are pretty ugly images.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's nudity and it's beer and it's people looking wasted and so on. I'd encourage them to find their way uptown on the parade route on a beautiful day, as you described. You're going to see families, and you're going to see families together and families sharing whatever they're cooking on the barbecue. I mean, that's one of the multisensory parts of riding down the parade route on the King's Float, is that the wonderful aromas of chicken and hamburgers and whatever else is being cooked. I mean, people plan this forever.
Yeah.
And this city comes together in such a special and a lovely way. And you just don't see those images enough when you go, if you Google Mardi Gras, what you're going to see is people who are drunk and doing bad things. And that's not what I see.
Well, you just hit something that's very near to my heart. The name of the podcast is Beyond Bourbon Street. And it was created after seeing, being home at the end of Mardi Gras, waiting for the meeting of the courts on television, and seeing the national news and the portrayal of Mardi Gras as nothing but Bourbon Street and right. lewd acts and the drunkenness. And having just come home from doing the same thing with my children that my parents did and their parents did, and that is spending the day on the neutral ground on St. Charles Avenue and seeing friends and meeting new friends and having too much chicken and maybe too much beer as I've gotten older, but really a sense of community. And when we tell people all the time, Mardi Gras is very much about family. What you see on TV is a very tiny piece, and truthfully, not what most New Orleanians experience or think about. So to hear you say that, I can only imagine the view. You had the best view on the day. What are your memories of that day when you got the opportunity?
So many happy faces. I mean, I've been blessed to be in this city and to work with families in this city for pushing 45 years. So I saw children who I knew well and their parents who I knew well. Sometimes I took care of both parents and children and knew the grandparents too. And that was true from the beginning to the end. And lots of signs that said, "Hail Rex, Hail Dr. Hales." It was very personal and happy. I mean, this is a wonderful day, almost impossible to describe. Mm-hmm. Even pictures don't do it justice. So anyone who's listening to this, I'd really encourage you to come and see this for yourself and be part of it. There's this funny thing that happens when someone who's never been to a Mardi Gras parade comes to the first one. You can't explain it. I remember when my aunt Laura, who was a very uptight woman who wore her gray hair in a bun, and we sort of dragged her to a Mardi Gras parade, and she had her arms crossed in front of her chest, and she couldn't figure this out at all. And after a while, I look over, and Laura's starting to move with the music a little bit, and she's almost starting to boogie, and then some doubloons started flying, and I saw her fighting a little boy for one, and I'm thinking, well, she's around the corner. So you sort of have to be here. And after being on St. Charles Avenue on Mardi Gras and having these parades go by and being part of that and participating in that, you're going to go home to other parades and they'll just not measure up.
No, I agree. I think seeing Mardi Gras through the eyes of children and visitors are the two best ways to do it.
Yep, there's a delight there. And again, hard to describe, wonderful to experience.
So precisely why, if this has got you energized or excited, you should come and experience it for yourself, because there really is nothing like it. Dr. Hales, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts and memories of Rex and the history of Carnival with us.
Now, this has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the discussion with Dr. Hales as much as I did. Even as a New Orleanian, it was fun to learn some new details about the Rex organization and how they see their role in both Carnival and in New Orleans as a whole. We do at least one episode a year on some aspect of Mardi Gras, and I already have several ideas for the next ones. We'll put links to those past episodes and to the Rex website over in the show notes at beyondbourbonst.com/84. You'll also find links to our sponsors, the Old 77 Hotel and Two Chicks Walking Tours. And be sure to use the discount codes and save some money when you visit.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone who loves New Orleans. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.